Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
So this week's parasha, we have episodes 1 and 2. We are only focused on episode 1. Episode 1 is the birth and birthright of Yaakov and Esav, which is this first sheet right in front of you over here, which we went through previous classes, all the texts. And you have three others. The long white sheet is Rashi's commentary. We have the blue sheet is the Ramban, and the yellow is Refersh. We were going to be flipping through back and forth again as we did last week. Where we are. Okay, so quick review of last week. For those of you who are not here, you can listen to it online at length. But quick review, we did the first two verses as we are now going through the in-depth. We went through the episode quickly. Just in the text, we raised lots of questions, and now we're going to start with some answers. So, we did the first two. In the first pasuk, Yitess 19, these are the generations of the offspring of Yitzchak, who was the son of Abraham. And then the pasuk concluded, Abraham begot Yitzchak. And we raised the question, why do we have that extraneous phrase that Avram is the father of Yitzchak? And we had five answers that we saw in the commentaries last week, ranging from that it was Avraham, after his name was changed, that's when he first gave birth to Yitzchak. We had the idea of it was indeed Avraham and not Avimelech, where Sarah had been taken captive, and the Torah is stressing that the face of Yitzchak looked just like the face of Abraham, so that the people were able to say, indeed, it is Abraham who gave birth to Yitzchak. From Abraham raised Yitzchak, that's what the pasuk is coming to say, or that it was specifically Abraham gave birth to Yitzchak and not Yishmael, meaning that the lineage of Abraham is going to follow through Yitzchak and not through his son. Okay, leave that as a rate.
I think you only said four.
Yeah, four. We had a fifth. Was it was stressing Rav Hirsch's approach is that Abraham gave birth to Yitzchak, stressing that the Yitzchak came through Abraham, as opposed to Yitzchak's wife, Rivka, who was going to be born in the next pasuk through a Besuel and from the house of a Lavan, and that mixture is going to create the twins that were going to be born, because they came from such different homes, one from the home of an Avraham and one from the home of a Besuel and a Lavan. We'll talk more about that as we go today. Pasuk 20 Chaf, again, just quick review of what we did last week. Yitzchak, we saw, was 40 years old when he gets married to Rivka, and we were told who Rivka is, the daughter of Besuel, the sister of Lavan, from the place of Padan Aram. And we raise the question ourselves, why do we need to be told all this? In the second verse of the story, we already know all this information, and we learned last week Rashi's interpretation. Rashi quotes from the sages that this is to tell praise of Rivka, that even though she was the daughter of Besuel, and even though she was the sister of Lavan, and even though she came from the place of Padan Aram, she still became such a righteous individual. And we studied last week the Maharal's comment. Maharal says, why is it so great that we need to know three different places where she came from if she has the courage and fortitude not to be impacted? So you told me once, why don't we need to know if she was not impacted from her father, not from her brother, not from her place? Because Maharal explains there are three things which primarily influence our behavior. We are either influenced out of fear. We behave because we don't want to be punished. We don't want to be looked at in a negative way. So we do certain things, but it really is based from a place of fear, and that's represented by her father. That even though she could have been influenced by his behavior and wanted to mimic and parallel his behavior out of fear, she still did not follow in his ways and went off on her own and became a righteous individual. And the second primary form of behavior is love. We like someone. So we want to do things like they do because we want to be like them. We want them to like us. We want them to think we're the same as them. High school. Just think high school. So says the Maharal after Rashi, saying, no, even though her brother, which would represent, I want to be like my older brother, whatever my older brother does, I do. Not because I'm afraid of him, it's because I want to be like him. So she wasn't influenced by him either. Not only was she not influenced by her father to act in his ways out of fear of punishment, she didn't act like her brother, which would have been a different source of inspiration, which would have been, do like him because I like him. He's cool. He's older. He's got all the friends. She didn't do that either. And the third major source of influence on our behavior is what we call hergel. We're just used to it. It's the way that we did things. I grew up in a community. I see that this is the way the community behaves. So I think it's normal. And I behave that way. And if you ask me, why are you doing that? I don't know. That's what everybody does. I won't even know to answer the question. Why am I doing what? I'm doing what, this is how I was raised, this is what everybody does. So even though she grew up in a place where there were norms of behavior, of societal standards, she was able to look past that and say, wait a minute, just because everybody's doing that doesn't make it normal, and I'm not going to do that, and therefore this is indeed a praise to her of being able to withstand all of those different elements. Okay, that was a quick 4-minute review of everything we did last week, but I encourage those who are not there, listen in online and you'll get the whole gist of it. Okay, let's move forward. So now back into our story. We're in verse 21. So here we have our introduction. We're introduced again to Yitzchak, the son of Avram. He gets married. He marries Rivka. And now, verse 21, they have no children. We're told nothing about them other than this. We know nothing about their 20 years of marriage, which we discover by the end of the story, because we are told that in the last verse, in verse 20, that Yitzchak was 40 when they got married. And at the end of our story, we're going to be told that he was 60 when the twins are born. So we know that they're married for 20 years. And we are told nothing about that 20-year period. There is apparently, from the Torah's perspective, nothing which took place from the time that they get married at the end of last week's parasha, when Yitzchak approaches and she comes off the camel and he brings her into the tent of his mother, and he's consoled and comforted from his mother Sarah's death. We are told nothing else about them until this episode 20 years later. What happens in verse 21? Vayetar Yitzchak l'Hashem l'noichach ishto. Yitzchak entreated Hashem, either regarding or opposite his wife. The word noichach is doubly translated. We'll see today in the commentaries why. What noichach has a couple of different meanings, either the opposite of or regarding. So Yitzchak is davening opposite his wife, or regards to his wife, entreating God, ki akorohi, because she was barren. Vayeyoselo Hashem, Hashem allowed himself to be entreated by him. Vatahar Rivka ishto, and his wife Rivka conceived. Okay, let's just go over the questions that we asked when we learned this the first time. Everyone remember a couple of questions we had?
Of course, I wasn't here, but I always wonder how old Rivka was when she got married.
Okay, so the sages say she was 3.
Is that really right?
The sages say she was 3. Whether or not they mean she was literally 3 or that in some element she was like a 3-year-old, they say she was 3. But whatever that means, as we did discuss this last week, she was old enough to be at the well by herself drawing water and able to water 10 camels, which is gallons and gallons of water. So whatever they mean when they say she was 3, she was not our modern day 3-year-old, clearly, because the text, it's impossible that she was on that level. So whatever they meant, but they say she's clearly young. Refersh, when he discussed that medrash, Refersh understood it in the sense that she was young enough to be influenced by the house of Avraham and become a scion in that realm. Okay, well we had some problems. What does it mean that he davened opposite her? Well, it's funny language that he's praying opposite her. We mentioned the question of
Hashem allowed himself. What is that?
Interesting. Hashem allowed himself to be entreated. We asked the question of what is this language of tefillah anyway? Vayei oser is a very interesting usage of to entreat somebody for something. And we asked the question of where is, who would you have thought? If you were going to say there's one person davening for a child in this relationship, you have Yitzchak and you have Rivka, who should it be?
Rivka.
Where is she? She's not part of this equation. Pasuk says Yitzchak davens on her behalf. Hashem allows himself to be entreated by him, and she conceives. Now we know that she has a very active role in this story because in the next pasuk, she's the one who's going to seek out help from God as to why she's having such a difficult pregnancy. But as far as the prayer aspect goes, she does not appear in our pasuk. Another question which we asked is the general concept of being barren. And don't we have a promise? God has already promised Avram numerous times that he will have children as numerous as the stars of the heaven, and that there will be a nation to be born out of them, and it's going to be through Yitzchak. So we know at some point, Yitzchak has to have children. So this whole idea of this barrenness, of having to entreat God to have a child, where does that fit into all of the prophecies that have already been said as far as that goes? Okay, so those are some of the issues that we had on this particular verse. Let's see if we can find some answers. Okay, your long white sheets, Rashi. Let's start with Rashi. Okay, let's take a look at Rashi. Rashi's on page 273. It's in your first page towards the bottom. We're going to get to the beginning of this verse. So Vayeyos, so the first thing Rashi discusses is the language of the type of tefillah that Yitzchak davens. Entreated. This means, says Rashi, he importuned much through prayer.
What does that mean?
Good question. What do you think that means? Importuned. He importuned much. Hiftir, hirba v'hiftir. So hirba literally means to increase. So I mentioned to you, I think when we went through this the first time, there are 10 different languages of prayer mentioned throughout the Chumash. That's possibly even more than that. At least 10 different words that are used to describe the concept of tefillah. And each one has a different aspect or a different element as to what is this type of tefillah. Rashi says, what does it mean, vaye oter? It means hirba v'hiftir. It means to be able to get something out, to prevail upon, by asking over and over and over and over again. To be hirba, to increase. So that there's a type of tefillah that is a incessant, repetitive, consistent, over. I need this. I really need this. I have to have it. I really need it. Which is a unique concept between the relationship between man and God that we do not find between man and man. If you would try this with your colleague, coworker, boss, spouse, child, parent, most people on the receiving end of this type of tefillah would get very frustrated, very annoyed, and would either give you what you want because they would say, "Enough already, leave me alone." But it wouldn't be out of love, and I like the sense of, I just love it when you ask me 30 times for the same thing over and over and over again. It's music to my ears as you ask over and over and over and over. It's a unique element, but when it comes to the man-God relationship, so Hashem just wants us to reach out and say, Ribono Shel Olam, I need this. I really need this. I have to have it. I'm desirous of this. I have to have it. I need it. I want it. Because each time is saying, you're the one who has what I want, and I turn to you when I need it. And that constant repetition, that over and over, is a form of tefillah. There's a form of tefillah that looks different, but it's a element, it's a form, it's a category of tefillah that just says, I'm just going to ask and entreaty and over again, beg and plead for that which it is that I think that I need. And that's pleasant and pleasing in the eyes of Hashem. Yeah, so you had a question?
Since he knows that he's going to have children because Hashem already said he was, why should he?
Right, so that's, we could ask that as a question or give that as an answer, or right. Let's just state it as a fact. What we see here is, not only is Yitzchak introducing us to a form of tefillah of Ribono Shel Olam, I need this, I need it, I need it, I have to have it. It's in the context of, I'm telling you I'm going to give it to you.
Yeah.
You're going to have it. And yet still, in the element of tefillah, when it comes to the relationship between man and Hashem, there's this content, I'll give it to you, I mean, you're going to get it, but it's when that relationship develops, and when it is that you ask for it, and when it is that you understand that I'm the one who's going to give it to you, and you recognize that, and ask, and beg, and plead, and see that I'm the one who's going to give it to you, I will give it indeed to you.
I have a connection with the Hashem needs the prayers of the righteous.
Yes, so we find that here also, totally. Now, Rashi does not quote that here. He's going to quote that later. Rashi is going to quote the idea of, we find all of the matriarchs were barren. We found it by Sarah, who has a child first at 89, 90. We find it here by Rivka, 20 years she's married. Ki akarohi, the Torah says. Why is Yitzchak davening this way? Because it's impossible to have a child. It's not just that I need help in the natural mechanisms that a child... It is impossible. She is barren. And we find it by Rachel as well, that she's barren. The sages say it was Leah also was barren, and that God specifically opened up her womb because he saw that she was not the favorite wife. But they were all barren, and that leads itself to that issue, which is not really unique to this particular source, so we're not going to focus so much on that, but that we do find, the sages point out, all of the matriarchs were barren, which we've seen two ideas behind that. One, that we are a miraculous people and should not be here based on the laws of nature. And that is a critical element that is established deeply in the origins of our people, that we are not normal. anyone says to you as a Jew, you're not normal, say, thank you. I know. We are not normal. Based on the normal laws of the land, of the world, of science, of sociology, of you name it, we should not be here. And it starts with our creation, with Avraham and Sarah not being able to have a child, Yitzhak and Rivka not being able to have a child, Yaakov and his wives not being able to have children. We are miraculous in nature, against the natural order, and that's why we're still here today, which we should not be here today based on all Afghani sociologists. We shouldn't be here. The afflictions that we've had, the anti-Semitism, the pogroms, the Inquisitions, the Holocaust, you name it, in exile for 2,000 years, no homeland, it doesn't make any sense. It's impossible that we're here. Yes, it is indeed impossible that we're here, because it's impossible that we're here. Our beginnings were impossible. That's idea number one. Idea number two is that we find all of the Avos davening for the ability to have children, and that our impossible nature is linked to God's desire for our prayers. That the impossible people are linked inextricably to that impossible people reaching out and saying, we recognize that everything comes from you, and we turn to you when we need that which we need, and we recognize that you're not limited by the laws of nature. You created the laws of nature, so in our impossible situation, we only get out of it by turning to the Creator and saying, we need you. And so God has sort of created a system in which we only exist through mankind reaching out and saying, you are the source of everything that we have. It is impossible otherwise. So he literally created an impossible situation. Turn to me and you'll see it's not impossible. It's impossible to you. From your human perspective, it's not impossible to me. And those two things go together, that yes, we're possible, and yes, it becomes possible when we turn to the Creator through tefillah.
My understanding is that tefillah is reflexive. So that when you're davening, it's doing something to you.
That's correct.
It's giving Hashem. So is this a building up of a relationship to a point where you get children and I got what I needed also?
Meaning from God's perspective? Mm-hmm. I can't really say that in the affirmative, because you can never say the words, God got what he needed. That's a theological impossibility. It's a discussion of, then, what does it mean that God desires the prayers of the righteous? But that's because of the theological implication. That's like a whole talk. So I can't just say yes.
But it could just be desiring for that person to get to the point.
Whatever it may be. In other words, there's a theological issue which we're not going to discuss today of, the sages say, God desires the prayers of the righteous. Whether or not that translates into God needs the prayers of the righteous is theologically sticky, to say those two words together, God and needs. God desires, that sages say, so I can say that. But there's a lot to talk about. I just skimmed the surface, but yeah, there's a lot there. Yeah.
All right, well, before when you said, well, wasn't Yitzchak promised that he would have children?
Yes.
I mean, here it says, Yitzchak entreated Hashem regarding his wife. So it could be that if Rachel didn't eventually have children, then he would have another wife.
Correct.
Through whom he would have.
Excellent. So we're going to see that idea. But first, she's going to talk about that idea that you see here, Yitzchak is the one davening. He was promised children, but it wasn't clear who he was promised children with. There was no prophecy ever that Rivka would be the mother of the next generation of Jews, only that Yitzchak would be the father. So you're standing at this point here in which Sarah had the same issue before also. I know that Avram receives this promise, but it's only much, much later that she actually receives a prophecy that it will be through her. But Rivka never gets that prophecy that it will be through her, which means that in her mind, or in Yitzchak, first we'll see this inside, what thought begins to creep in? And where do we find this girl? Well, we found her in the house of Bethuel and Laban, a bunch of wicked people. Maybe, wasn't good enough. Okay, let's move on. So we have Vayatzer. So Yitzchak davens in this unique language of just over and over and over again. L'noichach ishto. And Vayayoser. And Hashem allowed himself to be entreated. Rashi says in the bottom again of 273, he was prevailed upon, conciliated, and I'm persuaded by him. Now, I don't yet have an answer for this question as to what that means. I don't have an answer. The commentaries we're going to be studying do not address this. Why God needed to allow himself to be prevailed upon, as we've been discussing. Like, we're waiting for the next stage of Jewish history. He's promised a child to Yitzchak. Why is it that Vayeyasov, you have this language of God needing to be entreated or persuaded or prevailed upon? I don't have a good answer for that. But we'll leave it as a question, that somehow God is prevailed upon to answer. And Rashi explains that every time you see this language, it means through some intense beseechment or increasing, which we're not going to focus on right now. Let us move on. What is Lenoichach Ishto, opposite his wife? Flipping to the top of page 274. Rashi says, opposite his wife, this one, Yitzchak, stood in one corner while he prayed, and this one, Rivka, stood in the other corner and prayed. So Rashi picks up on the interesting language. It doesn't just say that he prayed in regards to his wife, but the language it uses opposite his wife. What would it mean to pray opposite his wife? Right? They stood in opposite corners, and they both prayed. Why do you think they did that?
Hearts were hurting.
From the chisa.
From the chisa, sure.
Well,
so I always thought of some type of a mechitza or tznias issue. That's what I always thought. The Maral says not that way. The Maral says the reason why they're in opposite corners is because a person should, in general, daven in an area where he's secluded so that he can concentrate and focus and not be disturbed by other people. And this is not, he doesn't say this explicitly, but it comes up from what he says, this is not a man-woman issue that they needed to be in opposite ends of the room. It's that each one needed to be able to be focused on what they needed to say. So you find your own place, your own quiet little corner to daven, irrespective of the fact that it happened to be in a manner. That wasn't the issue here. Just davening requires concentration. It requires serenity from the environment around you. When there are other people walking around or doing their thing, it's hard to concentrate. And it's mentioned in Halach and the Shulchan Aruch that a person should have a specific place to daven. Not only a specific shul, which is your shul that you go to, but within the shul you should have a specific place so that you're not disturbed, you know, your environment, you're familiar. And now, no one quoted it from here, but the Maral uses the same language that's used over there in the Shulchan Aruch by some of the commentators, not to be disturbed. So they went off Lenochach Ishto, opposite each other, so that they could both fully concentrate and do what it is that they're doing. Which is interesting that we ask the question, in the verse, we're only focused on Yitzchak. The verse says that Yitzchak davened, but hinted at the verse when it says Lenochach, opposite his wife, instead of just saying regarding his wife. If it wouldn't use the words that he davened regarding his wife, then it would have been she was knitting and he was davening for her. No. It says he davened opposite her because they were both davening. They were just doing it separately, but the focus is on him. And why is the focus on him? Says Rashi, a fascinating comment in his next comments, because it says God allowed himself to be entreated by him. Whose prayer was successful here? Clearly only Yitzchak's, because the Torah says clearly that God was entreated by him and not by her. Says Rashi, why? For the prayer of a righteous person who is the child of a wicked person is not comparable to the prayer of a righteous person who is the child of a righteous person. Fascinating insight, because we have many statements from the sages who say that a Baal Tshuva stands in a place where a person who was, you can't even compare. But when it comes to the prayers, here we find that Yitzchak is answered before Rivka. And Yitzchak's entreaty was the one that was successful, because he is a righteous individual, the son of a righteous individual, and she is a righteous individual, but the daughter of a wicked individual. And why would you say that this should be true when it comes to prayer, that such a person should have a greater power of being the descendant from a righteous one?
And also your ancestors sometimes
Okay, so we have certainly a possibility of what we would call zuchus avos, the merit of the forefathers. So in other words, so when Yitzchak is davening, not only does he have his own righteousness, but he's backed, so to speak, by his father. On that approach, I would say if you're a banker and two wealthy people come in for a loan, they're both wealthy individuals, they have a major project, they want to borrow $30 million to build a massive, I don't know if that's maybe even less than what they need, to build some type of office building. Complex, whatever they're building. So $30 million. It's a lot of money you want to borrow. So they both come in, and we're independently wealthy. And one of them has a father who's also independently wealthy. So they both have the $30 million in their pockets now to cover the loan, except one has an additional $30 million in his father's pocket. Whose application do you accept? It just, it comes with more backing. It comes with more weight. So Yitzhak comes, he doesn't just come with his own righteousness. He comes with his righteousness and he says, I got the sugar daddy ready to pop. Look what he comes with. So then he says, oh, I dealt with your father also years ago. He's good for the money. You're good for the money. You have no family backing. It's all on you. So you just have less weight. If it goes bad with you, there's nothing else behind you. I'm going this way. That's one approach that the righteous, who's descended from righteous, any other suggestions? Why would the righteous, the son of the righteous, have more powerful tefillah? So my only thought that I would suggest, and I'm not coming from having seen this anyway, my thought would be, when a descendant from a wicked person becomes righteous, I don't mean to say it's easy. I don't want to say it's easy. But what they're doing is they're charting their own path. They're rejecting the path of their parents, saying that it's wrong, and forging a path on their own of, this is truth. Now, that concept is not unique to wicked. That's like all children do that. They reject the path of their parents. They find, after they all do that, there's a rebellious nature in being a child and saying, my parents did it this way, and I want to do it my way. Now, sometimes it's somewhat close, sometimes it's very different, but it's a natural quest for independence, if you will, to forge a path. And as you're forging it, there's the excitement and the, I don't know exactly the word, of the newness of it. Compare that with the righteous, the son of the righteous, who grew up in a righteous home, who grew up davening three times a day, who grew up learning, who grew up with Shabbos, and he's righteous, not just going through the motions. He is truly righteous, which means forging that path, creating that excitement, that newness, that this is mine, within that which you could have easily just sort of had, trying to find it. So, I don't know if this is true or not, I'm just throwing this out as a suggestion. Rashi quotes from the sages that the prayers of the righteous, the son of the righteous, is more powerful, more potent. I'm coming with a suggestion, when you have the suggestion of the merit of the forefathers, which I think is a very valid suggestion. You also have, what's it like to be a righteous person, the son of righteous, to be truly righteous? It's very, very difficult from when you were brought up with it, and yet to still actually be righteous. But either way, be it as it may, when it comes to prayer, Torah makes it very clear that there's somehow an advantage of being descended from a righteous individual, even though, again, as we mentioned, in other elements, sages are clear that someone who is a Baal Tshuva, someone who did not come from a righteous home, can stand the Makom Shuhu Omen, the place that he stands, even the righteous can't stand. So there's a certain place that they occupy, which no one else can touch because of where it is that they came from. So there are different aspects and different elements. When it comes to prayer, it's clear that it is Yitzchak who carries the day. So, as far as Rashi is concerned, what we have here are the ideas of Yitzchak is the one who's davening. Rashi does not address, I shouldn't say this. The Torah says that Yitzchak is davening, but Rashi makes it clear they're really both davening. They're davening on opposite sides of the room. They're both there. Why is the focus on Yitzchak? Because it's his prayer which is eventually answered, because he has his father's backing as well. He's descended from the righteous. Rivka prays, but it's not her prayer which is answered. Okay, Ramban does not comment on this also, but take your yellow sheets, Rav Hirsch, on page 422. Now you'll notice on the top of the page, in verse 21, Rav Hirsch translates the verse in the, not with Rashi's opposite. Look at his translation. Yitzchak entreated God concerning his wife. That's the simple translation. Rashi's bothered by that particular use of words, which is why he said it means the opposite, that they were on the opposite end of the corner. Let's take a look at his comments on the bottom. Verse 21 says, Rav Hirsch, Iter is related to hater, or to bore into, or a machter, it's a breaking in. Meaning this is the type of tefillah that's the forcible pushing, like the forcible pushing forward of a ship against the wind. Those are the languages that the word is related to. Hence, Iter is a penetrating prayer and request, forcing the issue, saying it over and over, as Rashi said. Let's go to the next paragraph. The Nochach Ishto, on behalf of his wife, 20 long years had Yitzchak struggled in prayer before God for the fulfillment of the wish to have children from Rebekah. Now, again, note the way that he says that. How is Yitzchak davening? Not just to have children. He knows he's going to have children. What's he davening for 20 years? From this wife that you've given me. Remember, she was chosen in a fairly miraculous nature of this past week's parsha, where Eliezer goes to the well and he creates this whole test and she comes by. So it seemed pretty clear that she's going to be the one, but nothing is happening. 20 years go by and there are no children forthcoming. So 20 years he's praying to have children from her. The promise of Ki Yitzchak Yikarei Lecha Zera, that through Yitzchak you will have children, meaning he knew that Avram had been promised it was going to be through him you'll have children, that was known to him. So he knew that in any case, he could hope to have children. But whether the covenant of Avram would be carried on by one born from a sister of Lavan, this is what he commented last week also, if you remember, that the Torah is stressing the different backgrounds they're coming from. Yitzchak was born by an Avraham. Rivka, very different home. She came from the home of a loved one. Would that make it, in spite of her own excellency, on that, especially after waiting so long, he could well begin to have doubts. 20 years go by. Maybe, it wasn't going to happen through her. So that his prayer was lenochach ishto, specifically and specially referring to her. In other words, what's her first saying? What's the language? Lenochach ishto. Why is he davening regarding or opposite his wife? So Rashi picks up from the sages of opposite his wife. He tells us about where they were physically standing, teaching us a way of how you should pray. In your own place, by yourself. It's a private act. Refersh picks up on who was he davening for? Lenochach ishto. We asked this question also, if you remember, when we went through the verse. How many times did it say his wife in this verse? Twice it says, but seemingly completely unnecessary, because the previous verse said that they got married. We know that Yitzchak and Rivka are married, yet he davened for his wife, who conceived his wife. The first picks up on that, that's what his prayer was focused on. I want to have a child, which I know I'm going to have, but I want it to be through her and with her. Says the first, last two lines there, we see here how not only the first stone, meaning Abraham, but the further building up of the house of Israel had to come only as a direct gift from the almightiness of God. That like Sarah, Rivka too was an Akara, was barren. And her first pointed out, which we mentioned a few moments ago as well, the whole foundation of this home needed to be built miraculously. It needed to be built. It is an impossible building. It's an impossible structure that it can only stand as a result of God's desire for it to stand. That's who we are. We are only here because of that. Okay, here we have our big, the beginning of our story. So the first three verses were really about Yitzchak and Rivka. Now we get into the birth of the twins. Now we're going to see just in the three translations that we have a number of different translations of how to translate this word. It's a very interesting verb. We're going to see from the children crushed within her, the children agitated within her. Refersh is going to learn the children moved lustily against each other. It's a word that clearly has movement, agitation, some type of difficulty, but the pasuk itself is very bland as to in what way, over what, why. But there's something happening within her. She responds, in Cain, lama ze anochi, if so, why is it that I am? Or why am I thus? A very strange phrase. And she goes to inquire of Hashem. So questions that we asked on this were the obvious ones. What's this deal? Was this normal or abnormal to have this type of pregnancy? What kind of business was she experiencing? And what? How do we translate that question of hers? If so, why am I thus? What does that mean? What was she bothered by? What was she stating in such a question? Okay, let's take a look at Rashi first. You have your long white sheets in Rashi, page 274, middle of the page. Vayisroitzitzu, the children crushed. So Rashi understands the simple meaning of the word is to like crush against each other, which comes from the Targum Unkos, the translation that we have from Unkos. Rashi says, however, you must say that this verse begs us to expound it, meaning we have to explain this verse on more than a simple level, because it's too difficult to read on a simple translation level, because it's too vague. What is this crushing? And why does she respond? If so, why is it that I am? Rashi quotes two comments from the sages, two midrashim on understanding what's going on here between Yaakov and Esav. Number one, our rabbis expounded it of Lashon of Ritza, to mean running, rats. By Yisrotza Tzu, what's the root of that word? Rats. They were running within her. What would it mean that the two children were running within her? So this is the medrash which I'm sure most of you have heard at some point or another, that they would both run. That when she would pass by the entrance of a place of Torah study, of Shem ve'Ever, descendant Shem was one of Noach's sons, and Ever, one of the further, his descendants, they had a base medrash. When she would walk past, Yaakov would, so to speak, run to get out. And she would have this sense that one of the children was clamoring, I guess she didn't know that they were twins. She had the sense that the child within her was clamoring to get out. And when she would pass by a place of idolatry, Esav would toss about trying to get out. And she was rather confused because she didn't know she had twins. She just noticed that there were certain places when she would walk by the Beis Medrash, she would have this horrible sensation of a child trying to get out. And then when she would pass by a house of idolatry, again she would have the sensation of the child trying to get out. And she said to herself, this is odd. That at any given point I should have the sensation of a child trying to get out is strange, but that it should be in opposite scenarios when I pass by a Beis Medrash or when I pass by the house of idolatry, what's the deal with that? And she goes to seek from Hashem why it is that this is happening. That's interpretation of one. Rashi goes from the sages. That's the Vayisrotza to that they were running. Alternatively, Rashi adds, Misroitzitzinzem, that they were struggling with one another. Not that they were struggling to get out, which is the first interpretation of the sages, but they were struggling with each other and fighting over the inheritance of two worlds, this world and the next world. Interesting statement, huh? Now, they're very perplexing, but very significant. Now, what we need to deal with this is what we find here is the sages are picking up, the Torah is telling us a vague opening statement. The children, after 20 years of barrenness, she conceives, and she's having an odd pregnancy. Sages give two interpretations, either this the famous one of Yaakov trying to get out to the study halls, the Esav trying to get out to idolatry, or that they were fighting inside over two worlds, this world and the next world. Whichever one of these statements of the sages we look at, we go back to what we mentioned last week from Rabbi Freeman's comments on learning Medrash. Is this halachic in nature? Are we learning a halacha here?
No.
No, it doesn't make any difference in Jewish law. So what are the sages telling us? So that's the question. Like, what are they telling us? What do they want us to know from this? So whatever it is that they want us to know, that there's a fight, and then this is critical for our course. We are going through this. We're going to be studying Yaakov and Esav. We're going to be studying them from here almost the whole year in the three major episodes that we see. We're going to talk more about this. I just want to set it up now. As we go through their episodes, we go through the battle of their birth. We're going to learn in this particular first episode the selling of the birthright. We're then going to get to later in this week's parasha, it takes a while before we get there, the stealing of the blessings. And then we're going to get to the final meeting place when Yaakov returns to the land of Israel and the conflict, and then how that will then take us through all of history. Where did it begin? In the womb. And the sages say two things that Rashi quotes. A, Yaakov is drawn to the Beis Medrash, and Esav is drawn to idolatry, and B, they were fighting over two worlds. Now, why is it significant that the sages say they were fighting over two worlds, which means what are those two worlds? This world and the next world. As opposed to saying, Esav said, I'm taking this world, and Yaakov saying, I'll take the next world, then there wouldn't be a fight. There would be a pact. There would be an agreement. You can have this world. I'll take the next one. The sages don't say that. The sages say they were, because the Pasuk says, Vayisrotzitzu. They were fighting. They were agitating. And they were fighting over both. So we see the significance already in the womb. Does a child have free will in the womb? No. I mean, the answer is no. Talking about a newborn infant. Yet the sages are trying to convey a message that the battle between Yaakov and Esav is a battle which began before there's a Yetzer Hara, before there's an evil inclination, before there's a concept of free will decisions. There is something inherent, fundamentally different between what Yaakov stands for and what Esav stands for. That's not built upon decisions that they made that could have gone one way or another way, but that they are created differently. The words that we'll see probably more next week from the Maral, fire and water have different natures. It's not a matter of free will that fire and water conflict with each other, that they do different things, they serve different functions, they're at odds with each other. One will either evaporate the water or the water will extinguish the fire, but they can't coexist. It's just the nature of fire and the nature of water. That's how Hashem created them. There's a way to make peace between them, which is?
Keep them separate.
No, which is the famous book written by the famous rabbi affiliated with his town, The River, the Kettle, and the Bird. The kettle. What does the kettle do? The kettle combines the power of fire with the power of water through the medium of the pot, that they both can exert their power and coexist. Not only coexist, but create something even better out of it. You can cook. Without the kettle, the water falls on the fire and extinguishes it. But the kettle allows the water to maintain its existence, the fire to maintain its existence, and a new entity that's created. Talks about that as far as relationships of how you can combine different functions. But without that, they're at odds. Now, this doesn't mean to say that therefore Yaakov and Esav could never coexist. Maybe there was a method to put them together. But what we do see, from their inception, in the womb, there's a battle. There are two opposite strengths. They represent two forces in the world that are different. And it's not because Esav couldn't control his Yetzer Hara. The battle is, he's drawn to something else. Something different than Yaakov from the womb. We'll have to talk about this a lot because this is a concept which is going to manifest itself in many ways. But that this Rashi's quoting already from the sages, I want to at least see the commentaries of Ramban and Rafersh today before we get more into what this concept represents. But that from their inception, from the beginning, there is a fundamental difference between Yaakov and Esav. One is representative of Yaakov running towards the Beis Medrash and Esav representing running towards idolatry, and a second, they're fighting over the two worlds, both this world and the world to come, and there's a battle that already ensues while still in the womb. Okay, let's leave it at that. We're going to get back to this. We're going to have to see the Maral more inside, but there's a lot to talk about, but that's a Rashi quote on the word Vayisrotsutsu, that they agitated, that they crushed, that there was a battle taking place either amongst the two of them, or that they were both trying to push out towards different things, and we see that very early in their creation. What does she say? If so, why is this upon me? And Rashi's interpretation is, if so, that the pain of pregnancy is so great, why is it that I am what? Desiring and praying for pregnancy. Fascinating comment Rashi makes. What was she so about? Why did I so yearn, so desire, so pray for this, when I am struggling so with the pain of this pregnancy? So what did she do? She went to inquire of Hashem. Rashi comments, where did she go? To the house of study of shame and Aver, that he should tell her what will be at her end. Meaning at the end of the pregnancy, what is going to be with this? Now, Maral asks a very interesting question here, which we're also going to get back to very frequently. The pasuk itself said, where did she go? And so what did she want from the pasuk? The pasuk says, the verse only says,
To inquire of Hashem.
If you were Rivka, where would you go to inquire of Hashem? What were your options to find out what's going on over here?
To
Ask your husband.
You have a husband in Yitzchak and a father-in-law in Avraham who have a pretty direct line to the White House. And where does Rashi say she went?
Shem still living?
Yes. That's where she went, yes. So she goes to the house of study of Sheva Eimber. Now, Rashi got this from the sages. Sages understand that that's where she went. Now, this is very significant because this means that when she gets her answer, she's not getting the answer not from Avraham nor from Yitzchak. And one of the points that we've mentioned already as we went through this story is the response that she's going to get, the prophecy about her difficult pregnancy, that there are indeed twins in there, did not come from Yitzchak, and we do not know whether or not Yitzchak indeed ever finds this out. She went instead to the Beis Medrash of Shem Ve'Ever. The Maral suggests that the reason why she did that is that she was afraid to go both to Yitzchak and to Avraham, and that somehow this difficult pregnancy would reflect poorly on her and might indeed show that she was unworthy of this. And she was afraid of what they would think, so she stayed away from them. And she instead went to the Beis Medrash of Shem Ve'Ever, and then wants to see from there whether or not she shares what it is that she learned from there with them. But in any case, that's how Rashi learned. She wanted to know what was going to be at the end, what was going to happen with her. Take a look quickly at the Ramban. Ramban is on page, your blue sheet, page 5. Very bottom of that page, the Ramban quotes Rashi. Why does, again, her, he's going on the phrase that she said, if so, why am I thus? He quotes Rashi in the very bottom that if this is such a pain, why did I pray for this? And Rashi, Ramban says on the top of page 6, excuse me, I have the wrong page number. Yeah, no, all right. On the top of page 6, says Ramban, that is not satisfactory. Why not? To the question that we would have asked, really? Rivka Imenu, our mother Rivka, says Ramban, is having a difficult pregnancy, and she says, if so, why did I yearn for this? What do you mean, why did I yearn for this? You yearned for this because you wanted to be the mother of the Jewish people. So Ramban doesn't like Rashi's comments. He doesn't like that her question was, if so, why did I yearn for this? Instead, says the Ramban on the very bottom, the most satisfactory interpretation in my view is that she said, if this is what is happening to me, why am I in the world? If only I would not be here, meaning that I should die, or that I should never have been born in the first place.
She can't fulfill God's will. Is that what she's doubting?
Ramban is saying, if the pain is so great, I should never have been born in the first place. To which the Maral is going to say, that's not any better than what you rejected Rashi's for. You rejected Rashi's interpretation because you said it's not logical that Rivka would say, why did I yearn for this? Rivka's also not going to say, if only I would die. So it's very interesting to me, Rashi and the Ramban, I mean, this is as classic as it gets, these two commentaries, find in her question, very interesting questions of, why did I yearn for this? Or why am I even alive suffering through this? I don't have an explanation, only that Rashi and Ramban, this is not like me adding a commentary here, see in her question of Loma Ze Anochi, why am I thus, very, I would almost say, perplexing questions to our ears of, why did I yearn for this? This is so painful. Why am I alive? I can't take this. If only I would have never been born. The Maral, who lived 500 years after then, says, what she meant to ask was, why am I thus not doing anything? I should ask and find out what this is about. As the pasuk says, she went to inquire of Hashem. Why am I not doing anything? That's how we interpret the question. But Rashi and Ramban has a very interesting interpretation. They both see in her question of, why am I yearning for this? This is so difficult. Why am I alive? I don't yet have, I hope we'll come up with one, an understanding of their interpretations, of their comments, that will make more sense to our ears, but I don't have one yet. But that's how they understand this.
Could she really be asking the question, is she going to die?
So, it's possible. The Ramban's language doesn't sound like that's what her question was. It sounds more like your question was, reading it again.
Why am I still living? It's the way I'm interpreting thus.
Halavai sha'amus, if only I would not be. No, I don't believe that's fact. It says the first on page 422, in verse 22, Vayisrotzu, from the word roth, to run or to hasten. Each would not allow the other to rest. It gives a simple interpretation of the two children inside would not allow the other one any peace. And she responds, if so, Tomrim came, by the notation, these three words belong together. So it means, she said, when it was so, meaning when this occurred, why am I thus? Why do I have such an unusual experience? So she went to, according to the explanation of her sages, to Shem and Aver, those who had preserved the traditions of Noah, to ask for an interpretation from God through them to understand why it is that she is indeed experiencing this. Okay, so what we're left with is as follows, to summarize our two psukim that we learned this morning. Number one, Yitzchak davens. The focus is on Yitzchak. Yitzchak is the one who's eventually going to be answered. He is the descendant of a righteous individual, and his tefillah has more power than his wife, who was descended from a wicked person. 20 years go by while it's praying. They're on opposite sides, as Rashi learns. That's the way to daven. You should be with your own quiet self, which is always fascinating that we daven in a minyan. We have to figure out a way to be with a group of people and yet find our own personal peace and quiet within that. And then her pregnancy becomes very, very difficult. Rashi quotes two interpretations from the sages that we're going to get back to because of their extreme importance, that the sages see this battle, this conflict starting in the womb before free will, before they can express it. Their natures were at odds with each other, fighting over both this world and the next world, or fighting over idolatry versus the base medrash. We're going to get back to this again, as we'll mention many times. We'll get back to that. And she says, if so, why am I thus? We have Rashi and Ramban learning difficult interpretations. Rashi saying, why am I thus? Why did I yearn for this? Why did I want this so badly when it's so painful? And Ramban saying, if only I would die, if only I would never have been born in the first place and not have to have experiences. And she goes to seek out Hashem, which Rashi quotes, means not her husband or Avraham, seek the Beis Medrash or Shem and Aver to understand, why is this happening? What is going to be in the end with it? We'll pick up with that, Rav Hashem, next week.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.